You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting to Yes And.
And Nick Chater. Morton is the William R. Keenan Jr. Professor of Psychology at Cornell University, as well as Professor in Cognitive Science of Language at Aarhus University in Denmark. Nick, who's been on the podcast before, is a professor of behavioral science at Warwick University. He talked to us about his book, The Mind is Flat. They've co-authored a new work. It's called The Language Game, How Improvisation Created Language and Changed the World. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Morton and Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Well,
thank you
for having lovely us. To be here.
So I'm hoping we can start the discussion with a point you make actually at the end of the book in the epilogue. You're talking about AI and this idea of singularity, which is the point at which artificial intelligence exceeds human intelligence. This concept has, like, many people concerned, especially lately. But you note that, quote, computers haven't joined the human conversation. And then you go on to say, quote, they have no more understanding of language than a jukebox has of the songs it's playing, end quote. All right, so can you unpack that for me a little bit? And Nick, I'll go with you first.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is an issue that becomes ever more pressing as various versions of GPT and its kin become ever more impressive. But I think so one can, I think, get lured into thinking, wow, these things must just understand because look, they just do such amazing things. And I think that is really a fundamental mistake. So what we're saying in the language game is we're saying that if the human drive to communicate really precedes language. And what's driving it is this amazing ability to jointly reason and think about what arbitrary signals can mean, or what's, you know, sometimes less arbitrary, the iconic signal. So I'm trying to convince you that I'm signaling some particular movie title and I do some strange action, which I'm, you know, it's King Kong or something. Then I only have to flail around in vaguely the right direction. And you kind of know where I'm going. You think, well, that's supposed to be a gorilla. Oh, it's supposed to be sort of swiping at some aircraft. Oh, that's King Kong. And so it's assuming that we've got this very rich natural tendency to try to make sense of each other's behavior as communicative. And of course, once you've got some of those signals, those gestures, you can then reuse them and change them and modify them for new cases. And if you do that lots of times, particularly with the same people, you're going to start, they're going to become more and more conventionalized and standardized. And you're going to get something that starts to look like a language. I mean, in this case, a gestural sign language. But yeah, the same story would go for spoken languages. So for us, natural language we speak, is this kind of incredibly sophisticated but sort of veneer on this underlying communicative engine, which is driving us to try to make sense of each other. And usually, though the veneer is complicated and has a rich syntax and so on, actually, you still need that big communicative engine underneath, because everything we say is so massively ambiguous and so much depends on the context and what we just said. And, you know, any name we mention or anything we talk about, we have to have all this common understanding, which the engine is churning away thinking, you know, which John's that? And when you say that the word, you know, set, say, whatever, is this a set of tennis or is it a set in mathematics or what kind of set? And all of that stuff is just going on automatically. Now, you know, none of these large language models, GPT-3 or any other, that they're not in that game at all. They haven't got a communicative engine. They're not trying to express themselves. They're not thinking, you know, I've got something I want to communicate here and I'm trying to do it. They're doing something completely different. They're taking the output that we have produced, this vast splurge of language which we've generated across the web, and of course all these, you know, computer programs and so on that we've created, and they're hoovering that up and finding patterns in it. And that's just like an amazing thing. They're finding patterns which are, you know, amazingly sophisticated. And that's allowing them to complete the patterns. So, you know, here's a bit of conversation, here's a bit more, here's a bit of a story, here's a bit more. It's incredibly good. But there's no engine trying to drive the process forward. There's no desire to communicate because there's nothing to communicate. So I think it's just kind of a complete sort of category mistake to think these are, you know, what, in some sense, what's GPT 3, 4, or, you know, one day 10, what's it understanding? And what's it trying to say? It's not trying to say anything. It's just a pattern completing machine of an unbelievable cleverness. I mean, to say I am personally, I think what we feel the same, completely astounded by what's been achieved by these models would be an understatement. I am just amazed, but I just don't think they're not communicating with us, and we're not communicating with them. They've not joined the conversation.
So, Morten, one of the things, so my fields are comedy and improvisation. And in both instances, we have been asked or tasked or brought in to work with, I'll just say robots, but these different kinds of these models. And the two things I know is they're not funny. They have learned to tell a joke, which is one kind of comedy, and most of their jokes are puns, which is the easiest kind of comedy. So no sort of transformation. They can't do physical comedy. The whole world is not open to them. And they can't improvise, in part because what we discover when we're improvising is we're tapping into our divergent thinking. We're undoing patterns as opposed to the other, because that's the surprise and that's the funny thing. So I'm just wondering, from your sort of point of view and where you sit in this conversation, you know, what do you see? Is there a worry? Is there not a worry? What's interesting about it to you?
Yeah, I mean, just like Nick and what we say in the book, I mean, I think in a sense, the part of their impressiveness actually comes from the fact that they're sort of parasitic on all the work that we are doing as humans when we are communicating with one another. So when we are engaging in a conversation, we are trying to figure out what the other person is trying to say. And in doing that, we build on what we in the book call the communication iceberg, namely the notion that the words, the phrases, the sentences are really just the tip of a communication iceberg. And underneath that is knowledge of the cultural knowledge, factual knowledge, knowledge about how we tend to interact with other, social norms, etc. And all that stuff, these models are really not aware of. And that actually comes through when, if you try to apply the models to, say, other languages. So, for example, I have a part-time position in Denmark, and some of my colleagues there have been looking at whether GPT-3, when it does Danish, whether it's sensitive to some of the unique cultural aspects of sort of Danish life and so on. And it's not. So it'll make all sort of, you know, cultural faux pas and so on that that would be work fine in say, in the US, but wouldn't work in Denmark simply because the differences in culture. So all that kind of information is stuff that we sort of bring to bear on a communicative interaction, and that they're sort of missing that. So they can't really do this improvisation to the same degree that we can. Having said that, though, one of the things that I've been doing is actually been working with these models to try to make them produce poetry, which is sort of thought of as sort of one of the sort of pinnacles of linguistic creativity. And I have to say, they're actually pretty good. And so we are sort of making GPT-3 or 3.5 or whatever the version is now to create, for example, poetry in the style of Shakespeare, Lord Byron, Claude McKay, Walt Whitman, Gertrude Stein, or Emily Dickinson. And they actually, I mean, what they produce is pretty good. Some of it is sort of just pure plagiarism, but some of it is actually quite good. And so this shows the power of pure pattern completion, as Nick was mentioning earlier. What they're really good at is picking up on patterns, including patterns in how we write, and sort of kind of reproduce that. But they're not really engaging in this sort of back and forth that is sort of crucial and fundamental to sort of human communication.
And we have to give them a bit of the break on the Danish, because, I mean, like, human beings aren't great at it either, as we've talked about in your book.
Yeah, that is true. That Danish is a bit of a puzzle, and which is something I've been working on, and it's, you know, quite exciting. But nonetheless, sort of the cultural part, they ought to fit. The cultural part, they ought to be able to sort of at least capture the degree that humans can. But because they're not really trained up on that, they're sort of missing that bit.
And going back to your point about jokes, Kelly, I mean, the fact is that, you know, humans have created jokes as a form, and the ones that tend to be out there on the web are presumably, you know, funny enough that people are repeating them to each other. Yep. So there's a kind of a human achievement. And then the GPT-3's trick is finding patterns in those jokes and generating more, which, you know, fit those patterns. But GPT-3 could just as well have done anything, right? I mean, if you created some, you know, sequence of words with any kind of logic whatsoever, you know, let's put words in alphabetical order, or let's have, you know, lots of palindromes or whatever you like, you know, it's going to think, okay, yeah, you've put those on in the corpus. I'll learn that structure. I'll do that too. It doesn't care, right? It's not doesn't think. It's not like it's thinking, oh, these are really funny, and here's an even funnier one. It's just by taking the patterns you give it, and it will give them back to you. And it's really good at it. But because we're sort of pattern finding systems ourselves, we see those patterns. We think, well, clearly there's intelligence behind this. It's a bit like, you know, thinking it's the sort of blind watchmaker problem. You see a watch and think someone made it, and then you see a beetle and you think, well, clearly someone made that too. And you see this joke and it's kind of not too bad. Well, yeah, clearly an intelligent being created that, but really it didn't. It's an amalgam of past jokes, and we made them, right? They didn't come from nowhere.
Interesting. All right, so let's talk a bit about before your research, before your book. So this idea of where did people think language came from? And you talk about this metaphor of someone sort of chiseling it from a single block of raw marble, which gives the idea that there is this, that it just exists, that it's already there. And then we're extracting it. Can you talk a bit more about what that, and this is like Noam Chomsky, right? And even Steve Pinker and people like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been a long standing tradition that somehow language is sort of built into the mind, that it's sort of pre-existing in some form that exists in the mind. And sort of that's the notion of it's already there and needs to be sort of chiseled out by chipping away on some and finding the underlying structure in language. However, when you look at language sort of more generally, and in particular when you look at the amazing diversity of languages that we see across the world, there's more than 7,000 different languages, and there's all sort of different ways in which people use various components to sort of indicate differences in meaning. So some languages like Chinese have tones, others have clicks. Then, of course, we have sign language that doesn't use either of those. And then you have languages where something that seemed to be fundamental to the way we think about language, like having nouns and verbs and adjectives and adverbs, where they don't seem to exist as well, but there don't seem to be any differences between them. So a language like Straight Sailors up in Canada, that does seem to be the case there. So what you see is just an amazing diversity across languages that doesn't quite fit with this notion that it's all sort of just one kind of system that Chomsky initially envisaged.
Yeah, and just to add to that, I mean, when we started working on language together, which is a long time ago now, this was, you know, the very early 90s, when we were both graduate students and beyond in Edinburgh. And after that, we've been working together ever since. Then the sort of received view was that languages had common patterns, really deep common patterns across all languages. So it was sort of stylized mystery fact. It's like, well, how is it that all these languages, they all have these deep common universal patterns? And one possible explanation for that would be, of course, the universal grammar idea, the idea that there's a grammar which is built into each child, and that's genetics in somehow or wired into the brain. And each language is a kind of variation on that pattern. In one particular version was that there's a sort of set of parameters that universal grammar has, and learning a language is kind of tuning those parameters. But it turned out it's just not a stylized fact at all. It's a kind of fantasy stylized fact. It's because, you know, people hadn't really looked very closely at many languages, or at least the people producing the theory, Chomsky and the people close to Chomsky, were primarily focusing on English and, you know, one or two other languages. But But if you look at more languages which are much further away from English, they have, you know, all kinds of extraordinary and really rich and diverse patterns. And so that's, you know, just a kind of a deep sort of empirical fact that, you know, this kind of universality that was supposedly standing in need of explanation was really being imposed. It was kind of like, you know, every language would be jammed into the theoretical framework, and then one would say, well, there it is, here's another one with these same patterns. But in fact, you know, that's just wrong. I mean, it's just empirically, you know, it's empirically false. So I think that's one thing. And the other related point is that even within a language, enormous amounts of the complexity of that language don't really fit within the kind of classical universal grammar type of framework anyway. There's just enormous amounts of irregularity and sort of semi-regularity and conflicting patterns in languages of, you know, just every language is like this. And so it's a really puzzling thing. If you imagine there's this kind of universal basis to languages, a kind of pure, sort of mathematically well-defined structure that every language is supposed to have, which is kind of coming from our genes, then you'd think languages would be both similar to each other, but also they'd be kind of neat, tidy things. And they're just a complete mess at every level. Mm-hmm. Now, that makes much more sense if they've kind of grown organically from the bottom up. But if they're kind of being driven top down, it's just a very puzzling. And a way to size that problem, if you're taking a universal grammar perspective, is to say, all of this messy stuff, now these are just sort of marginal cases. The really important things in language are the things that are deep and important, are universal, and all this other stuff is, you know, not very important. And I mean, a linguist that we're both very, very impressed with, Peter Kulikova, has a style of argument which I think undermines this pretty tremendously, where he says, well, look, if child's got to learn all this messy stuff, so if he can learn all this messy, quasi-regular stuff, then learning the regular stuff is going to be super easy. I mean, that's just not the problem, right? If you the complexity of language is all this irregularity. Mm-hmm. So any learning system that can figure that out from scratch can easily figure out any underlying deep irregularities. That's trivial by comparison. So then the whole motivation for having this kind of universal blueprint starts to sort of crumble into the dust, I think. And of course, you might want to say something about this, Morten, but there's also a sort of GPT-3 type of it point here, isn't there? That
yes,
you know, give that idea.
The fact that when you look at the output of GPT-3 or ChatGPT and so on, that even though sometimes they can be, you know, they can say things that are nonsensical or doesn't quite make sense, but crucially, pretty much always it's grammatical. So what you have here, you have a system that actually is exceptionally good in producing grammatical language, yet clearly there's no universal grammar inside of these models. There's no pre-built rules or anything like that, similar to what was actually originally suggested by Chomsky and others. So what this suggests is that we have sort of an existence proof that just essentially vacuuming up loads and loads of words, doing pattern completion over it, can allow a system, a learner, a silicon one in this case, to produce fully grammatical language. Now, the meaning part and the communicative part, that's missing. But the grammatical part can be done without any kind of built-in grammar.
It's funny to think of, you know, I'll talk to tons of people in business, but also professors. And, you know, this idea that almost every business problem is a communication problem, and the idea that somehow that's not messy, like we can barely talk to each other and understand what's happening in any given situation and circumstance. And we get it wrong so much more than we get it right. This, and I know the hindsight, right? It seems so obvious now, and of course didn't before. And I know you talk in the book to Alan Alda, who we had in the podcast, who studied with Second City, and even before that with Viola Spolin, who created all these exercises, the improv games that we have been teaching for years and still, and she was a social worker. She was literally working with immigrant children and kids on the south side of Chicago and bringing them in to teach them how to empathize and communicate. And a lot of her exercises and the ones that we still teach today are silent or in gibberish because the kids didn't share language, but they could communicate. So it's like, it feels very like, and talk a little bit about, like, Nick, I know you're not a stranger to improvisation, where you see that fit in, especially when you talk to Alan and the work he's doing at Stony Brook.
Well, I'll say a bit about the improvisation thing. I think So two points that are interesting here. I mean, one is that the mind is in general an improviser. So, and this is the, yeah, this is something that Morton and I have thought about in the context of language a lot. And the mind is flat, to give it a plug. The old mind is flat from 2018. I mean, that's really the theme of that book. But it's really built into the kind of thing that Morton and I have been thinking about for a long time. So the idea that instead of, we shouldn't be thinking of ourselves as consulting a kind of fixed theory of grammar or a fixed theory of human nature. It's not that I have a fixed understanding of how people work or how the physical world works. I mean, the world is far too complicated, and indeed language is too complicated, and other people are too complicated for me to have a theory of them. That's just not the way we work. So the miracle of, you know, human ability to skate on the thin ice of this complexity is that we are continually improvising, dealing with creating new solutions based primarily on similar cases we've dealt with before. So we're thinking, well, here's a weird new situation. It's a little bit like these other ones. And those cases, I kind of did this. So let's try this. And if you ask the question, is that going to be completely consistent? Is that going to deal with every possible case? No, it isn't. It's you're muddling through. You're coping with the situation you're in right now. The world is too complicated to have a model of it, of the whole thing. So that's just the general point that improvisation isn't a kind of a poor surrogate where the ideal scenario would be to figure everything out and have a perfect plan. The world is never going to allow you to do that because it's too complicated. You're always going to be improvising. And then the other thing is that a lot of the time, in fact, most of the interesting things humans do, we're doing together as we are now. But in almost all of our lives, we're doing things together. So we're improvising jointly. And one of the things we've got to do in improvising jointly is coordinate our behavior. We've got to do things that mesh in a logical way so we're not, as it were, tripping over each other. And of course, communication is a crucial, essential part of that. So this process of thinking, improvising our communication and improvising our joint behavior, that's fundamental to what humans do. And I think actually it's really... It may not be unique to humans, but it's really distinctive of humans versus other species. We're just really, really deeply joint creatures. We spend a huge amount of time spending our lives doing things together and talking to each other, where there's no real equivalent of that in other species. But the final thing that always strikes me as interesting here is that I think we're the kind of classic view of language from the sort of early cognitive science and early linguistics days, it sort of sees language as fundamentally a way of encoding information. So the idea is that we have these thoughts, and the thoughts are possibly represented in some logical language or system. And now they're kind of clear. The thoughts are clear. And then your thoughts are clear too. And I've just got to get some thoughts to you. And I'm going to do it by, as we're bottling some up in a bit of packaging some up in some language, I'm going to send it to you as if I'm sending you a packet of information over a computer network. But really that's a mistake because my thoughts are not clear and your thoughts aren't clear either. And in the process of communication, that improvisation is a large part of thinking. So rather than thinking, well, I know exactly what message I'm trying to send, how am I going to do it? Most of the time, it's a sort of joint, the process of figuring out what to say is kind of also just doing the thinking in the first place. And it is never clear. It's always an improvised and to some extent muddled. And never gets, everything can be probed, everything can be prodded, everything can be clarified, but never completely. There's that process of sort of improvisation and refinement and hitting you barriers and clashes. That's just the way it goes. And so I think the perspective we often have as human beings, I think, certainly is that communication is blooming difficult. If only we could solve it, like as if we could solve it just by being better at communicating, we just, the barriers would fall down. But that's just a complete mistake because it's just inevitably difficult because it's a bit like thinking, decision-making. Oh dear, if we could just fix that. I mean, like, how could that ever be? The world is infinitely complicated. There's no solution to the question of how to make good decisions in every situation. And there's no solution to the question of how to perfectly communicate. It's just an endless struggle of being a human being is that we fight this battle afresh every day.
This is the thing, and more now I want to talk to you about this because it's funny. I read so many business books, and so many are like, this is the 7 points to secure yourself for life or business. Like, there are so many different contexts that you could never have one theory that would cover everything at any given time. And I was right before we started taping, I was on another person's podcast and we were talking about the difficulty people have with listening. And she said, could you play an improv exercise with me to help me with that? And so the one that I did with her is called Last Word. And it's very simple. We started a conversation. The only rule for each of us is that we need to start our sentence with the last word the other person said. So it's as simple as listening to the end of a sentence. But then also the game we're trying to win here is one in which you say that word and you maybe pause reflectively to find the way it might fit inside the conversation. And we actually ended up having probably a deeper conversation at that moment than we would have had I been planning the smart thing that I needed to say halfway through what she was saying, which is kind of what we do. So Martin, can you talk more on that and how we communicate?
Yes. And that's actually, I can imagine that actually initially that's actually a quite hard exercise to do.
It is hard.
Because one of the things that happened during normal conversation is that the time between turns, between I finish saying something and you will start saying something is actually on average, and this is across languages and across cultures, is about a quarter of a second. And what that means is that we actually have to try to prepare what we want to say before the other person have already finished their turn. Because if I was to ask you to, for example, if I was to show you a picture of, say, cat, and all you have to do is say cat, that would take you about 600 milliseconds to do that. So what it means is that you have to prepare and start thinking about what you're going to be saying before I finish what I'm saying. Hmm. And so doing that, so it's a good exercise because it sort of kind of forces us to get out of this normal mode of very rapid turn-taking, sort of rapid-fire interaction, which is sort of the normal way of interacting. And I think another aspect of it is also that, surprisingly, that a lot of this study of language has been focusing essentially on language as monologue, which of course is not how we use it actually to communicate. And so it's been treating it as such. And then, and of course, as a monologue, we typically have time to prepare it and think about it or write or something. But in actual real life turn taking, we have to be really fast at responding, because otherwise, essentially, if I hesitate a little bit, then that's an opening for you to sort of start saying whatever you want to say. And there's something about sort of holding the floor, as it were, in terms of interacting. But on the flip side, it means that we have to engage with the other person. We have to sort of try to think about, okay, what is it the other person is trying to tell me? How can I best express myself so that you can understand? And importantly, in normal conversation, we have a lot of devices, conversational devices that we can use to make sure we're understanding one another. So, for example, one of the things we do is we tend to nod, or we say mm-hmm, and so on. Of course, the listeners can't actually see us nodding right now or anything like that. But that's something we use. It's called back channeling. We use that all the time. It's like almost every minute or so, there's a nod or there's uh-huh and something like that. Another thing we can do is, of course, sometimes things go awry. So the conversation, so I misunderstand something you're trying to say and so on. So ask for a repair. I can ask you to, what did you say? Who did you mean this and that? And we do that also very often. So we use these to sort of keep making sure that we are sort of engaging with one another in the right kind of way. But you don't really see that when you see monologue on television or in books and so on. And that's the impression that we get is that language is much neater than it actually is when it's really messy when we're using it in a natural way, like we're doing now, sort of interacting sort of real time, as it were.
So there's an interesting story at Second City. David Mamet was a busboy. This is back in like in the 60s. And in part because Second City creates its shows through improvisation, almost always the characters that they create on stage are speaking like human speak. And we don't do a lot of parody. So there's not a lot of sort of accents or big wacky characters, that sort of thing. And so Mamet, who was known certainly in his early career for this naturalistic dialogue that people found incredible, he's talked about this before because I've gone to talks that he's given where he's like, yeah, but I mean, I was kind of parodying what I saw happening at Second City, and I had a real connection with people. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And that was so new to the theater because I think prior to that, the theater operated in very much like monologue, monologue, monologue. And then sort of as contemporary theater evolves, as you know, our understanding of language or whatever, he found a different way to replicate something that felt like, oh, no, that's kind of how people talk. And it's awkward.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, isn't it? That it's actually a major innovation to present back to us on stage the way we actually are. And that's kind of weird. You think that would be the obvious thing to do, because like without as it were thought, when we do that naturally. But of course it's not the case, because the person writing the play is not there in a dialogue. So if you're making a play in an improvised way, you're doing that, you know, through workshopping, then you're going to produce something of a very different style, because that then has now indeed fed back to the way writers write. And of course, you know, an awful lot of corporate realistic screen drama absolutely has that character, doesn't it? Although, you know, actually much less so than you think. When you really sort of take
much less so than you think. That's
You think, well, they're just like real people. But then hang on, yeah, that was a whole paragraph of quite fluent English. I don't hear that from many people very often. Yeah, but still, yeah, we've clearly been influenced in that direction. And this general point about monologue being treated as basic is just so distorting in our perspective on what language is. I mean, going back to the point about the messiness of language, if you started off with transcripts of people just burbling on, you'd never think, oh, there's this, you know, there's this universal grammar, there's this incredibly tidy structure. But when you, as it were, look at very, very sophisticated, highly stylized written text, then that, you know, they have more of this characteristic. But of course they do, because you know, we're actively imposing that on them as sort of thoughtful writers. It's not the groundwork. I mean, going back to the thing we were saying at the beginning, the groundwork of human language is this, you know, is this drive to just get stuff across to people in the moment by whatever means possible, and that will include sort of noises and gestures and facial expressions and all kinds of other stuff. Whatever does the job, and I'm thinking of sort of what is essentially a very stylized art form of written language, and viewing that as the prototype is a, you know, it's a kind of bizarre inversion of what you'd imagine would happen. But that's the way the psychology of language went from, you know, sort of 1950s and 60s onwards for some decades.
Morten, can you tell us about? I got a real kick out of the Thomas Schelling experiment about meeting a stranger tomorrow in New York City with no way of contacting them. Can you talk about that experiment and then how that relates to the book?
Sure. I mean, so Thomas Schelling, he was, you know, got a Nobel Prize in economics. I forget when it was, a few years ago. But a lot of his work was essentially about negotiation and how we can sort of find common ground, or what he called focal points. And so he actually did some interesting sort of kind of experiments with his students in New York City, where they had to sort of meet up. And so you might think that if I was to ask you, you know, pick a space-time location tomorrow in New York City, that's impossible, because it's like, I can't remember how many square miles New York City is, but it's huge, or five boroughs, like millions of people and so on. It's impossible. Now, if I instead ask you to, and this is what Schelling did, if I ask you to sort of come up with a place that somebody else that is just like you, somebody sitting next to you might also find. And so what you're trying to do is think, okay, what might another person who might be thinking sort of roughly along the same lines as me, or have the sort of same kind of cultural background, where might they potentially want to meet me? And so what comes to mind are sort of what Schelling calls these focal points, or sort of optimal solutions, or near optimal solutions, such as 12 noon Grand Central Station, or 12 noon Times Square. Now, what you wouldn't say would be something like, you know, 2:47 a.m. On the corner of, you know, 47th Street and some other avenues or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know New York that well, so I can't really give good directions there. And he did some other experiments that were sort of similar to that. And he actually made his student go out do this. And you know, many kind of times they would actually meet up. And so what that suggests is that if we sort of are trying to come up with solutions that other people like ourselves might also come up with, it's much easier to coordinate in that way, even if we just have to guess. And that's sort of the point of that. And what we are suggesting is that language is a lot like that, that when kids are sort of entering into the language, it's not like there's just random stuff for them to learn. What they have to learn is something that other people, just like themselves, have created, and they have the same kind of limitations or constraints imposed on them. And so when children are making guesses about what to say in what situation, they're making guesses that are pretty good. In a sense, they're making sort of guesses that are analogous to sort of time 12 noon at times central square, no, Times Square or Grand Central Station. That's what they're doing. And so what we are suggesting is that by following in each other's footsteps, that actually makes language acquisition much easier than what was previously thought, where it was thought to be sort of a logical problem. How could children learn language when it's so messy? We just talked about how messy language is when it's so messy and there's so many sort of complications to it. How could they ever learn to speak sort of fluent language? But they do, and they do because they're essentially trying to do the same thing as other people who came before them who are just like themselves.
Hmm. Yeah, when I was reading this, it also made me think a bit about, I've interviewed a few different people who talk about the way generational trauma lives in the body, and this idea that for, you know, centuries, these sort of things can sort of exist. And so it seemed akin a little bit in terms of like, well, you know, this stuff evolves and stays with us. And I think you write in the book something about, you say, quote, "How are children able to improvise in just the right way to join in with linguistic charades? The solution is beautifully simple. Every current speaker was a child once." So it's simply about the fact that we're all part of this sort of human journey and this sort of linking, which quite frankly feels a little more elegant than the ideas that sort of were thrown around before. I'm actually curious, Nick, like, are you getting blowback on this? Are people in your community being like, no, you got it wrong?
Well, I think, I mean, it is a slightly riven field, the cognitive science of language. So there are unquestionably, there are supporters of the, what once upon a time was the dominant view that universal grammar is innate in each child and that all languages have a common pattern and so on. But I think that simply isn't the dominant view anymore. I mean, it's not just us, right? There's just been a general revolution in the field. And it's not really, in terms of being different kinds of approaches in linguistics, construction grammar in particular, which is a much looser, more bottom-up style of grammar, which is just doesn't really have the same characteristics as the Chomsky style grammar. That's just very much more dominant now. All these huge advances in computational language have just changed the story. I mean, the story that, well, this empiricist strategy of learning language from the bottom up, it could absolutely never work, couldn't even learn the most trivial thing, but actually look, here's GPT-3 learning the whole of the syntax of language. Yeah, it's pretty much completely perfectly. But there's just so many things that have shifted. I think what we're doing now is pretty mainstream. It certainly wasn't mainstream. And in our working lives, it has flipped from being a kind of slightly far out to being kind of the mainstream position. But I think of course there's going to be blowback. There is blowback, but I think much less than we would perhaps anticipate. I don't know what you think, Morten.
Yes, I mean, it certainly has changed quite dramatically from when we started working on these kind of things. That it seems that it really has changed that. As we're learning more about how children actually acquire language, just how good learners they are, and as we know much more about the kind of variety of patterns that are in language itself, using computational means, we can sort of analyze and finding all sort of clues that kids can use to figure out what is meant and so on. And as we are becoming much better at creating computational models like GPT-3 that can learn aspects of language, it's sort of kind of shifting that we can actually show now that actually, look, kids can learn this. Here's the information available in the input. And actually there are sort of simple computational systems that can actually pick up on this. And so now we're beginning to actually show empirically that this idea that was thought to be crazy 30 years ago is actually has some validity to it, and we can actually show that it works. And so I think that's part of what's happened, that we're getting much more data that kind of fits this view, and that doesn't seem to be consistent with the old view.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know from 30 years ago, you know, trying to convince companies why they needed to train their, you know, employees to improvise, like, was work. And it is no longer work. We hire people just to pick up the phone with people calling. And then the fact that things like the U.S. Army teaches improvisation, and, you know, like, you're like, okay, well, I mean, the soil has changed. All right, Morten, we always end the podcast for our first-time guests. We ask them for a yes-and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, of course, people's default position is normally to say no or do nothing. And yes-and is really a nudge to get people to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten whatever is in front of them. So do you have a yes-and story for us?
Yes, I do. And actually, it's related to some of the things we actually started talking about today, cool. Namely GPT-3. So initially in the book, in the epilogue, we actually talked about Watson from IBM. And we had some discussion of that and some of the limitations on AI and so on. And then my wife had come across GPT-3. This was actually 2 years ago before, you know, the press really got hold of it or anything like that. And she was saying, why don't you look into this? And it's like, well, we already written this and it's a nice chapter and so on. And then we looked into it, and then Nick and I looked at it, and we found actually that this was much more interesting. And it actually turned out to be incredibly like a scoop for the book, in sense that we are able to write about it before it really became very popular. So as when ChatGPT came out, like in November of last year, you know, suddenly it took off and the press is all about it. And now there's a lot of interactions about it. But when we wrote about it, and there was much less interested. So we just kind of, it was really fortuitous that I, you know, listened to my wife.
Yes.
And we picked up on this suggestion, and that actually changed that final epilogue on the book.
I'm going to say yes, anding your spouse, good move across the board. So Nick, you've been on the podcast before and shared a yes and story. You can do that again, or we can challenge you for a thank you because this idea of how do we stay inside a difficult conversation with people, and maybe that's by expressing gratitude and finding a point of connection. So either, do you have one of those new stories for us?
Yeah, I'm going to try a thank you because. I'm not sure I handled it very well. So I remember giving a talk in Germany on this sort of improvised approach to the mind, and being fairly strongly challenged by a very famous economist, who I won't name, very, very nice and very clever, very famous economist, who was saying, look, you know, it's just completely obvious that this idea that there's this kind of, we don't really know what we want, and we're continually trying to figure it out. I mean, how true is that? Because, you know, surely what we want is bliss. You know, we want perfect happiness. And we know that when we experience it, I mean, we avoid misery. And what planet are you on if you don't think that's what you're aiming for? And this was, you know, very surprising to me, because I thought, well, surely these economists, they just, you know, they put this into their models. And this is mostly true, actually, is a mathematical convenience. They have this utility, they put it in a model, and off they go. But they don't actually think, you know, utility, like in my head, and I'm trying to maximize it. But this person, who's, as I say, a very brilliant, remarkable economist, was saying, no, that's how it is. And not only is it true for me, it's true for you, and you just don't realize it. I can't understand you. And I think the conversation was really interesting, but it was the way it evolved was me thinking, wow, that's kind of, you know, that's really interesting. I just, you know, I don't know how does that work out for you? Let's think about some examples. Like, you know, what would it mean to make you really happy? And we went into a strange conversation about, oh, well, obviously I'd be really, really happy if I could fly. That'd be just absolutely fantastic. I'd be so much happier if I could fly. And you think, this is getting crazier and crazier. But the thing that was very interesting, I think, was the sense that, you know, by rather than thinking, no, that's wrong, and here's some sort of theoretical reasons why I think you're wrong, it was more like, let's go with that. Let's take that somewhere, see where it goes. And when you realize, oh, right, so, you know, your sense of, you know, what you want from life is your flying ability, to say, let's go in a strange direction. Let's go a bit further. And that, yeah, I mean, suddenly I came away thinking, okay, I sort of see this person's perspective on the world is really, really different from mine. And I would like to think he maybe came away thinking, do I really think that seems very odd? But maybe not. Maybe he's feeling completely happy where he was. But it was certainly a really interesting, it stuck with me, that conversation, as you can tell.
I love that, because so in improvisation, we teach about replacing blame with curiosity. in this idea, like let's just be curious and sort of see what happens, because you can be surprised. And it's funny, Paul Bloom's, not his most recent book, but his previous book, The Sweet Spot, was all about the fact that we make, like, having children is not like a happy thing. Like, there's no bliss in that. They're just, and getting married, and they, like, all probably the most important things that we do are all riddled with anxiety and often grief and trauma and all those things. So that is just so funny that someone would, that's where they would anchor. But this is why we have the conversations. We're all improvising. I love the book. It's called The Language Game: How Improvisation Created Language and Changed the World. Morten Christensen and Nick Chater, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you so much, Kelly. It's been a real pleasure. It's been great.
It's great fun.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.